Hello, my name is Marjorie Wingrove, and I'm your host of Death Happens, broadcast through the facilities of Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF. I've created this show as a way to normalize the conversation around death-related topics. Death is inevitable for every living thing. I believe knowledge and preparation can create some comfort and peace of mind. My guest today is Jacob James. Jacob is an actor from Kingston, Ontario, who spent a great amount of his career at the Stratford Festival, as well as a wide scope of other theatres. Today we're talking about the importance of legacy, passing along stories from one generation to the next. We talk about the lingering of spirit and the necessity for connection.
Jacob James, welcome to Death Happens.
Thank you so much. I'm really pleased and I'm honored that you asked me to be here.
Well, we're going to be talking about a couple of things that you're doing right now through the theater curation project that you've got going on YouTube. As somebody with a theater background, I remember as a young actor in theater school or fresh out of theater school and, you know, visiting theaters and seeing the older guard, I guess,
yep.
You know, going to the bars afterwards and listening to those stories, just wanting to, all I wanted was just to soak up those stories. So what you're doing with the theater curation project feeds that for young actors. And you said that you're a theater professor at Queen's and your students are benefiting from the curation project.
But I was set to do my third production of Billy Bishop Goes to War, which is a one-person show with a piano player where you play like 21 characters by yourself. Scenes where there's four people in the scene, but you're all four people, you know, like that kind of thing. Six songs, three flight scenes, two acts, 100 pages of lines. And I'd done it twice before over the years, and I'd relearned it all. And I was going to go start on March 26th, 2020, which was the day before my birthday, which is World Theater Day, incidentally. It was about a week before that they called it and they canceled it. And everyone else in the theater business was sitting there going, okay, it's not happening. It's not going to be happening for a while. And Richard Monette, who was my mentor all those years at Stratford, he really instilled in me the duty of passing on the tradition. And, you know, that if you don't, parts of it will get lost forever. Like he said, we'll never know what's already been lost. I was very keenly aware of seeing theater, the danger of it diminish over the extended time of it not happening. What are the things I am missing, literally, like, I mean, aside from being on stage, but it's so much about the community, the conversations that we'd be having. And it would often be, oh, I was working with so-and-so and this happened, and then someone says, oh yeah, I worked with so-and-so and they taught me this and this and this. And I realize, you know, that is what Richard was talking about. That's how it's an oral tradition and it's getting passed on that way. That's not happening either, right? So I just thought, okay, well, you know, reach out. I've made a lot of friends along the way. I'll reach out and say, can you send me a 5 to 10 minute video where you talk about a mentor or a person who made an impact in your journey and what the lesson was that they taught you? And I was so just overwhelmed, you know, and grateful at how the frequency with which I'm receiving videos. It's like, it's sort of making me go, well, this is going to go on for years if I release one a week. But they're pouring in, and we're almost at 40 episodes published, and that's not even what I have in the bank, you know, ready to go. So, and it's growing, it's gathering a lot of momentum, and people seem to be getting something from this. And as a prof at Queen's, adapting to being remote and online this term, which is new for me, I was already, last year was my first rodeo as a professor. So I've taught a lot before, but with an office professor kind of thing, you know, it's like that was my first time, and that was in person. So this is adapting to being on a computer in a Zoom room. I thought, okay, well, this will be a great teaching tool. What I'll do is what I've done is I assign them a weekly writing assignment where they choose one of the videos and they write the reflections on what they feel the benefits of the lesson is, so that hopefully the lesson continues. You know, when I'm dead, that person will have passed it on to someone, and when they're dead, the person they passed it on to, and so on. Then I got thinking about other conversations. I was like, what else am I missing that we would be talking about? And a major thing for me, I'm really into the paranormal, very interested. You know, I'm an amateur paranormal investigator because I'm got a bit of equipment, and because I'm always in these theaters, so I'd just stay late and stuff. So anyway, I would often ask people if they ever had any haunted theater experiences, and it always turned into great conversations. So I put a thing on the Theater Curation Facebook group page, a little post being like, you know, have you ever worked in a haunted theater? You know, what was your experience? Just to see if there'd be interest, you know, and there was an avalanche of interest in the comment thread. And I thought, okay, maybe I'll create a secondary series. So there's the Mentor Stories series that I spoke about. And then there's now the Haunted Theater Stories series, where you get an artist speaking about haunted theater they worked at and what their paranormal or unexplainable experience was there. I'll talk about this here because I talked about it on my buddy Tyler Murray's podcast, Murr's Nerds. We have some plans over at the Theater Curation Project too. You know, these theaters are sitting dormant right now. There's no one there. I know a lot of artistic directors that I become friends with. And so I'm hoping that I'll be able to start going into some of these theaters and doing some actual paranormal investigations that then I can put up in the channel under the Haunted Theater Story series as kind of specials or special presentations that are more long form, probably, you know, half hour or 45 minute episodes, right? The other thing about it is that before the lockdown rules came in, we had formed a little homeschool pod with our kids. I have a six-year-old son. That's terrible. He's six now. I have a six-year-old son, two other actor parent couples in town in Stratford here. We got our kids together so they could not be going into the schools, doing school remote and online, but together as a little trio. But the beauty is when we are bubbled together that way, when it's allowed and when it's safe, you know, I've got access to, I guess I can say who they are. It doesn't really matter, but there's my son's mom, Shalina Kennedy, who is a pretty big Broadway star. And then the other parents are Graham Abbey and Michelle Giroux, who are Stratford legendary quarterbacks, and Gord Miller and Martha Farrell, who are of my generation. Gord just played Iago last year in Othello at Stratford. And so what my thinking is if they're in my bubble with me, then I can bring them as guests on these paranormal investigations. So it wouldn't just be me alone. You'd have the guest for the Academy Theatre in London, because she had done some stuff there early on right out of Sheridan. Would probably be Shalina, because she's got a connection to the building, but it'd be hilarious. I'm a thorough and skeptical believer, but a thorough investigator, and I've got my practice with that. But she'd be like just losing her mind and screaming if anything happened, and that would probably just make for good entertainment. But, you know, and then another place I could have me and Graham Abbey, and then me and whoever, you know. So I think that would be kind of fun, because it's artists. It's all about community, and it's all about the preservation of the art and craft of theater and the tradition of theater, to try to do whatever I can to help theater, you know, from being diminished from a pandemic. Like it's like, because that's the thing, I'm sitting there going, oh my God, like I can't let this happen, but what can I do, you know? And it's like, and you know, I'm not saying I'm gonna save the whole industry of theater with this YouTube channel, you know, but it might help. And ultimately, that's the thing, is like, it's a balm for those of us who are disenfranchised, but ultimately it's for when we're all long dead. It's for the people, you know, the next soldiers of the future of the theater that we'll never know, because we'll be long gone. But hopefully all of this knowledge, these lessons, these stories, you know, this history will be recorded and be a resource to future generations.
Yeah. And theater in Canada being so young that we still have people who have worked with the founders of theater in Canada, the founders of Stratford, and people who can tell those stories still firsthand.
Oh yeah. Kenneth Welsh. He's done a mentor story. He did a mentor story on Powis Thomas, who's one of the creators of the National Theatre School of Canada. Like, he knew him, and it's such an intimate story. It's not just, I've got two Powis Thomas stories in the series so far, which is, one is Ken Welsh, the other's Jojo Rideout, who was one of my teachers at NTS. They both tell the story of Powis not just in a factual way of what he accomplished and what he did. Like, it gives you a real glimpse into the pathos of who Powys Thomas was, like what it felt like to be with him. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Like, my main mentors when I was at Stratford, I've been fortunate to have mentors all through, starting with Valerie Robertson in Kingston, Ontario.
Oh my God.
Do you know Val?
I worked at Theatre 5.
Oh, see, that's what I'm talking about. Oh my God, there you go.
Oh my gosh.
It all goes back to Valerie Robertson.
Yes.
So Val was my Yoda, right, of my theatre training. This is the beginning, right? And it's like Ian Malcolm, my high school drama teacher, goes on and on and on. But at Stratford, my main mentors, I spent 7 seasons at Stratford. And it's all I really cared about when I was a kid was going to NTS and then Stratford. And I figured I'd just grow old. But then the artistic directors changed and I was off on my way like Sir Gawain. But my mentors at Stratford were officially, technically, like we all were assigned a mentor, and I ended up getting to, I just asked somebody to be my mentor. It was Richard Manette who ran the joint, but it was because he came to my rescue when I was being a bit bullied. And then I was like, wait a minute, this guy's done everything I want to do. And he just stood up for me. I'm like, that's my mentor. And so he was my main mentor. I'm so blessed. Like I got to work in so many shows, whether he was directing or I was acting with him, with Brian Bedford. My first role was Moth in Love's Labour's Lost. My first role at Stratford, it was Moth in Love's Labour's Lost opposite Brian Bedford as Don Armato. Being alone on stage with him. And then, you know, and we did, like, he let me be Tim in Noises Off. He could have had any of the actors in the whole company, and he let me be one of the, like, 6 people in Noises Off. Incredible. And then, and this was, I'd read the books about him. I'd kind of idolized this guy, but I ended up getting to play Ariel opposite William Hutt in his final Tempest. You don't understand, because like when I was a kid, I would on the go with Ian Malcolm would take us on the high school trips, right, to Stratford. And I was the kid that went to the stage door when I was supposed to go to the bus, you know, and to meet them. And I remember meeting Bill Hutt as a kid, and I shook his hand and I said, I'm Jacob James, I'm in high school, but when I'm going to work here and we're going to be good friends. And he was like, oh, you think so, eh? Then here I am, I ended up getting to do shared verse with him on the festival stage alone. Every day it was just too much. And you know, after the first read, I was like, you know, we met before. And he's like, oh really? And I told him the whole thing, and he goes, well, you're here. And I was like, yeah. And he goes, whether we become good friends remains to be seen. And then he got in his car and drove off, but we did. But all to say, I would give so much to be able to have a conversation with any of them again, or all of them again. I think we experience this with all the people we lose in our lives. There's always something we didn't ask them or talk about with them or tell them that we wish we had or could. And so that, I think, is like the subtextual driving force under the whole theater curation project thing, is like, let's collect as many of these anecdotal tellings of important, vital lessons for the tradition of the theater, so that we're not sitting there 10 years later going, why didn't I make videos of that person telling me stuff? You know what I mean? Like, simple as that. And I hope that anyone listening, you know, goes and checks it out. And if you like it, subscribing really helps.
Yes, because I think I haven't made my way through all the stories yet.
Well, there's a lot now, you know, like, I don't blame you. There's it's growing very rapidly. Oh, and I should say too, we're going to be very soon. We've kind of teased it, but we're going to be launching our theater curation project online coaching team, where it's going to be a series of coaches that are available of all the different genres and of theater performance. There's going to be more to come in terms of stage management and design coachings that will become available later. But there's right now, it's just focused on the acting the musical theater and the dance movement. Also just general theater school-y kind of coaching, you know, like vocal coaching and all of that dropping in and, you know, and everything. But we've got some pretty amazing people on in there. I should have the list in front of me, but there's quite a few. Just to name a few, like Mev Beattie, Crystal Kiren is one of our major movement people. Jason Sermonia is also one of our major movement people. Shane Carty, who's a dear old buddy of mine, another townie from Kingston. He is, and I myself too am going to be available as a coach. But there's more. I've got Celicia Thomas, who I met from my days in New York, who was in Beautiful with Shalina, but she was also going to be playing a major role in the new Britney Spears musical before the pandemic, you know, on Broadway. Anyway, there's quite a few, but there'll be more information coming for that. But I also want to extend the Theater Curation Project into offering practical opportunities for people to develop the craft and the art, as well as talk about it and learn about the history. Do you know what I mean? And you know, and hopefully it'll work in tandem that people will use the mentor stories as a resource to look at these lessons and then work on the application of those through the coaches. Perhaps maybe one day it'll become the biggest theater school in Canada. Who knows?
Well, it's incredible. What an incredible way to have access to unbelievable teachers. That's mind blowing to me.
One-on-one coachings, you know, like, I mean, you get to work specifically on what you need to do.
Wow. I want to talk more about the haunted theaters. One thing that's on my mind about exploring hauntings in theaters is that, of course, theaters are going to be haunted because you've got people coming through doing shows, hundreds of people through the year doing rep, whatever else. And channeling. I mean, actors are just constantly channeling. So what a brilliant place for ghosts to stay and hang out. And some of the ghosts are, you know, I guess there are audience members and there are stagehands and there are artistic directors, as in Theater Aquarius, right?
Yep. As far as I understand it, there's a few different categories of hauntings, you may call them. Residual, meaning, you know, the lady in white walks from that room to that room at 3 a.m. every Friday or whatever. Do you know what I mean? But it's sort of like a record on loop. Or there's an intelligent kind of haunting, which is, you know, something that can seemingly see and hear you, but you can't see or hear it. Do you know what I mean? And then there's a kind of the poltergeist kind of thing, which is, you know, the cupboards opening and shutting and stuff. And at that point, I usually cancel any investigating if I'm seeing too much of that stuff go on, because from my research, it's something you don't really want to play around with, I don't think. But what I deal mainly the most in our is audio investigation. There's a thing called it's something called EVP, which is electronic voice phenomena, and it's ultimately it's using a digital recorder, you know, to pick up anomalous sounds that are perhaps happening on frequencies we're not hearing with our naked ear. You know, we know that there's things like dog whistles, that the dogs are hearing it, but we can't hear it. Theory is that, you know, the microphone on the digital recorder is able to capture frequencies we're not able to hear and then translate it into an MP3 that we can then listen to. I'm here to tell you that, like, you know, I just started off having a laugh with it, but it's like, and I'll be the first person to say, it doesn't prove that it's the voice of a person who once lived who's now a ghost, but it certainly is evidence of something speaking that I can't see or didn't hear. And then the next level of it is kind of to take it further is to ask specific questions that require specific answers. Do you know, if you say, like, what color shirt am I wearing? And you go like this, do you know what I mean? And you're tugging on your shirt. And if you get an EVP response of blue, then it would stand to reason at that point that whatever the source of that voice is can see at least and hear you. But then what I'm so curious about is, well, what is that then? Why? Like, what's the relationship? Like, what is happening here? Do you know what I mean? And if there's some way to kind of dig deeper and get to the bottom of that question or explore, get more answers. Yes, clearly I'm nerdgasming now about ghosty ghost stuff. But, I imagine if I'm a ghost one day I'll probably be hanging out in theaters. I wonder if when theaters operate, when they actually do, when it's not a pandemic, you know, as an actor, I've always been drawn to doing theater because whether you're on stage or you're in the audience or you're backstage, where you're all engaging in the act of empathy. And I remember as a kid going, oh God, like when I first understood what empathy was, I was like, if the world had more empathy, there wouldn't be the wars and the greed and the, you know, the hunger. And it's like theater is like an empathy factory. You know, they say there's this theory that, you know, the audience's heart beats a line and things like that, you know, like something energetic happens in there when you're sitting in a room. And why are we inclined to do that, to go sit in a room full of a bunch of other people and witness something together? You know what I mean? It's like, there's got to be something more to it. I would think as a ghost, that would be something that would draw them, I would imagine. The energy, that collective energy of an audience in a place, just hanging out there when nobody's there too.
Yeah.
So I have a near-death experience. It happened when I was 18 during the ice storm of 98 that hit Kingston and Montreal really badly. And so it was a couple days after. I ended up kind of stuck out in Joyceville at my best friend James's mom's place. And we had a rehearsal for, Val was directing us in a kids show of Cinderella, and I was playing the nerdy Prince Charming, right? We thought we'd make an attempt to get in from Joyceville, and it's like, but everything was an ice rink at that point. Like the storm was done, but it was in the fallout where like people didn't have energy and it was bad. So we made this attempt to go, and his mom was driving. I was sitting behind her in the back. It's one of those country highways where there's houses every 2 kilometers, you know, but otherwise it's just the woods, you know. So we're coming around this kind of bend that's going to go down into a descent, and I remember saying, I was like, careful you're not speeding. The next thing we know, the car started spinning out of control. And at this point, what I remember is this, that everything inside the car was slow motion, and everything outside, like from outside the window, was in fast forward. Okay. And then I remember turning, I'm behind the driver, remember? So I'm turning and looking out my window and seeing a like wooden electrical post kind of come out of nowhere and then right at me. And I'd closed my eyes, so it went black like it does when you close your eyes, but I distinctly remember it going white from the outside in, like a negative image of an old silent movie fade. Do you know what I mean? And then it was white, but then I woke up in the ambulance and James's mom was sitting there. I was the one laying down. She was like along as a passenger. And we're going, is what happened to James? Is James okay? And she's like, he's okay. And then I was out, and then I was in a hospital, and doctors like, pee in this cup, and I did, and then I was out, and then I woke up again, and my mom and dad were there, and they're taking bandages off my face, like the old Michael Keaton Joker Batman, you know. My mom's, you know, and my dad's trying to be stoic. So that was it. And I looked at my face and it was like, you can just kind of, we're on Zoom so you can see, but you can see that little scar there. And it was sort of up here too. But when it happened, it was just grotesque, you know, it's like in stitches. I'd gone to see Phantom of the Opera 5 times. I was obsessed with Colm Wilkinson, and I was looking at myself in the mirror and I was like, I'm the Phantom now. Like, luckily it healed up into this cute little scar and now I can play bad guys, you know, so it's okay. Anyway, so all to say, like, so then finally I said to James, like, after, you know, all that had happened, I was like, what happened from your point of view? You know what I mean? And he said, what happened was I said, careful, you're not speeding. We're spinning out of control. We made the impact. And then he looked to his mom. He was sitting shotgun, so he's right beside his mom. So he looks over to his mom. He's like, are you okay? And she's like, yes, are you okay? And he's like, yeah. And then he looked back, and apparently I was laying there like this with all the blood coming off my, like all on my face and, you know, and unconscious, right? And he's yelling my name and yelling my name and yelling my name. And apparently I wasn't doing anything, and he thought I was dead. And then I did one of these, according to James, I did one of these where I was just laying there and just went, you know, and breathed in a big thing of air and then started breathing again. You know, and it just so happened, I swear my spirit guides have really been looking after me, is like, we crashed right in front of one of the houses that would have been every 2 kilometers, right? Had we not, that would have been maybe a different story. So James who's been my best friend since we were 3 years old, bolted out of the car and ran right into these people's house. Like, he didn't even knock. He just ran, opened the door and ran into this. And was like, we have to call the police. There's been a... And it turned out that it was the house of a retired firefighter. He came, apparently, like, I have no memory of this, but he came out and knew, like, what to do and what not to do. Do you know what I mean? With the state I was in until the ambulance got there. Remember, an ambulance coming from Kingston, too, to the middle of, in between Joyceville and Kingston. It's, you know, bit of a drive, right? I can cap it off by telling you this. So years and years later, I was living in New York City, which I do from time to time, not anymore. I ended up going in to see one of those neon light psychic mediums on 14th Street. Because my friend, who was a skeptic to the point of being a bully, was like, I went to this place and she knew names. She knew, like, there's stuff she couldn't have known, you know. I happened upon the place and I went in, and it turned into this huge, huge session. But at one point, you know, and I wasn't giving her anything, like nothing. I'm not like, I know how this goes. Like, I'm not giving you anything to go on, you know. But she did. She knew names. She knew dates. She knew, like, it was the real deal. And then she this was the thing that got me, though, is she goes, you're like me, you know, like, you can do this. You just haven't developed the muscle, you know. You started to, but, which is true. I kind of did start to, but she's like, you know, you're not only connected to the afterlife, you know, because of your imaginary friends when you were a kid, which were, had peculiar names, which she named them. Their names are too weird. And it's like, and so she's like, they weren't just imaginary friends. But she goes, but you crossed the veil, but you didn't go into the white light. Like, she's like, you crossed the veil and you were told you had to come back because there's more things you need to do, you know. And that's been a big question in my mind, right, ever since, you know, she said this. But anyway, so, you know, so she's saying this and everything, and I'm kind of still, I'm trying not to give her anything. She goes, but you crossed the veil when you were in the accident with all the ice and the snow when you were 18. And I was like, oh shit, you know, that's, what else is that? I chalk that up to a real deal, like a near-death experience, you know. I think that's exactly what that was. So that's certainly amplified my fascination with the paranormal and, you know, investigating it. But also, you know, the loss of my grandpa, who was my very, very best friend and, like, the best person I ever knew. He's the only person I've ever, like, witnessed die. I was holding his hand when he passed, and my mom was holding the other hand, and you felt that bizarre sensation of, like, there's a triangle of energy right now. And then suddenly, after three last breaths and then nothing, there were just two people in the room. There was just one, like, bond between two people of energy. There was no more triangle of energy. And so it immediately begs the question, where did he go? And then you see it, like, you see the body as the shell. Do you know what I mean? And I'll be the first to say, I don't think anyone's going to be able to say what happens when we die until they've tried it themselves. Do you know what I mean? And I'm not saying that I know because I had this near-death experience. All I know is I woke up to a doctor saying pee in a cup and I saw a bit of white, you know? That's all I can tell you, but you get the picture.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to tell your listeners about the Theater Curation Project. And again, I hope everyone goes and checks it out. Just go onto YouTube, type in Theater Curation Project, and subscribe if you like it.
Thank you, Jacob James, for joining me today on Death Happens. My name is Marjorie Wingrove. Here is Charlotte Moore with Friends Ain't Supposed to Die Till They're Old.
Statues are old now, and they're names are so faded, you can hardly see. But the faces are always young to me. Friends ain't supposed.